Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage Podcast. I'm your host, John Slickbaum, and today we're going to dive into a topic that cuts to one of the most important elements of national security, strategic deterrence. In everyday speak, nuclear weapons. For years, we've all watched the debate. It's been incredibly predictable. The arms control community and advocates of the nuclear triad exchange their sides talking points that have barely changed over the years. But let's face it, the world's changed a lot as the years have rolled on by. Public priorities, the security environment, and technologies have evolved significantly. So we wanted to understand where reality really stands on this issue versus what we see in the op-ed columns or somewhere else. And if you want to understand public opinion, you need to cut to the source. So we partnered with Seven Letter Insight to execute a poll. And I'll be honest, we were really surprised with the results. It's been three decades since the American public has had to think seriously about strategic deterrence amid the pressures of the Cold War. In the meantime, we fought two conflicts whose results were far from positive, and we thought this would spark some healthy skepticism regarding the return on investment defense capabilities provides. But the results indicate something very different. Now, to better understand this, we have Mark Gunzinger.
Hi, Slick.
Major General Larry Stutzream.
Great to be back again with you, Slick.
And Doug Berkey of the Mitchell team.
Hey, man.
We also have Matt George of Seven Letter Insight with us here today to talk through these issues. And before we dive into the results of the poll, I want to jump into some strategic deterrence 101 to help baseline this discussion. So, Stutz, there are two very definitive sides when it comes to strategic nuclear deterrence. Would you walk us through the two perspectives?
Well, deterrence is an interesting topic. Let me just give some background. You know, it's a fundamental principle of humanity going back a couple thousand years. Think of it this way. You know, if I want to deter you from doing something I don't want you to do, and I know rewards won't change your mind, I can resort to threats of violence. However, for this to work, I need to have the ability to hurt you. I must demonstrate the gumption or the will to hurt you if you refuse to stop. And you have to believe I have both the ability and will to hurt you. In other words, deterrence is a two-brain game in which, you know, the calculus in the brain of my adversary results in a logic that says, I believe he's serious. I think he can do it. He has the power to hurt me. And maybe what I'm trying to do is not worth the potential of the outcome, being crushed. So that's, you know, basically what we're talking about. But at the higher end of this here is the nuclear arsenals of both the United States and adversaries. Now, there's two policy camps in this debate about modernization and the preservation of the nuclear deterrence, and they're in very different zones. Those that believe the nuclear triad remains the highest level of force that can deter an adversary, you know, that is our land-based ICBMs, our sea-launched ballistic missiles, and our nuclear bombers, they believe that triad remains an essential backstop for U.S. national security. And they assert keeping a strong nuclear deterrent is, no kidding, existential to the United States. And this camp, of course, obviously supports modernization and continued support for the importance of that nuclear triad and deterrence. Okay, at the other end of the discussion are those that place arms reduction and elimination of nuclear weapons as the priority. They don't want a modernized nuclear triad, especially the land-based ICBMs, which are about to be replaced. And there is also the belief that deterrence is perhaps the primary goal is not deterrence, but that elimination or reduction of arms. And there's a certain Pollyanna innocence, naivety about this, because our allies and partners and other people across the planet have decided they're not going to obtain their own nuclear weapons because the U.S. has assured them that they will extend our nuclear umbrella over them. So if we do reduce and eliminate nuclear weapons, this camp needs to understand there could be a very quick proliferation of nuclear weapons among many nations on the planet.
Yeah, I really appreciate that rundown, Stutz. Of course, you know, the idea of a road to zero would be great, but the other side obviously has to participate as well. Yes. So switching gears, Gonzo, you actually have experience as a B-52 bomber pilot standing nuclear alert. So can you walk us through the thinking behind the triad and why not a dyad or even a monad?
Sure. Well, we've had a triad since the early 60s. And the fact is it consists of weapon systems that really complement each other in attributes. The sea-based leg of the triad consisting of SSBN submarines carrying ICBM or sea-launch ballistic missiles, it's highly survivable. Perhaps less so in the future as technologies advance and they're better able to detect movements of our submarine force at sea. And then you take a look at the bomber force. It's also survivable if deployed and dispersed, but currently our nuclear-capable B-52s are located at two bases, Minot Air Force Base and Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana. And then, of course, the nuclear-capable B-2s are Whiteman Air Force Base. So I would call the bomber force the most stabilizing leg of the triad because it gives our commander-in-chief multiple options to demonstrate our willingness to respond to a potential attack. It really enhances deterrence because he can disperse the bomber fleet in a time of heightened tensions, or he could even launch the bomber fleet to hold points to indicate that we are serious. If you attack us, you can expect a response. Then we come to the ICBM force of Minuteman III's, of which there are 400 operationally deployed missiles in 400 separate silos. And I believe, even as a bomber pilot, that is the most important leg of the triad, because that Minuteman III force is dispersed over 30,000 square miles in five states. And it's what some people call a missile sink. An attacker would have to launch nuclear warheads, one, perhaps two, nuclear weapons at each one of those silos to ensure he can knock them out in a preemptive or first strike attack. And that is such a high threshold for an attack. It would guarantee a devastating response for the United States. If you get rid of the ICBM force and go to a dyad of bombers and SSBNs only, then an enemy would only have to strike six or seven targets and a couple of those SSBNs that are deployed at sea to be able to take out our nuclear force. And it doesn't make sense to lower that that threshold to within reach of, say, a future North Korea and maybe even an Iran.
Gonzo's is Doug just jumping in here, too. There's a difference between, hey, does a submarine just kind of disappear at sea and people wonder what happens and maybe it was taken out by an enemy versus an attack on the continental United States. I mean, we've seen this time and time again, whether it's Russia's invasion of Crimea or Chinese action in South China Sea. I mean, it's just fundamentally different. Is there an attack on the U.S.? And I think that's fundamental to what Stutz is talking about, true deterrence. I mean, there have got to be very clear lines here.
That's absolutely correct.
Yeah, well, Doug, I want to bring you in on this as the poll that we did was your initiative over the past few months, and I hit upon it a little bit up front, but why did you want to do this?
No, Slick, you really did a good job framing it up. You know, we've observed this issue for years. Obviously, as Stutz alluded to, we're big believers in the triad and strategic deterrence, but we've also watched the talking points between the two sides kind of go back and forth for years, and they really haven't changed a lot. In fact, you can kind of do find or place for things being said today and take back to the Reagan administration. They're largely the same arguments. And so, look, yeah, we have a position in this, but we also are a fact-based entity, and we want to know where the ground truth is with public sentiment. It matters a lot. We're a democracy. What do people really think? And if we're going to engage in this issue, we need to engage in a relevant, informed fashion and kind of know where the ground truth is and all of that. And so right now we're in a tremendous modernization period for the triad, whether it's the ICBM leg, it's being modernized through a program called Ground-Based Strategic Deterrent, GBSD. Obviously the bomber leg with B-21, and then the submarine leg with the new Columbia class subs. And so it's a huge, huge issue in Congress right now. And we just really wanted to know, is what we're seeing in the op-ed page fed by different interest groups kind of reflecting reality, or is it somewhere else within the public stance? And that's really what drove it, is honestly, we wanted to know truth.
Yeah, Doug, I'd like to add one thing. Back to the three legs of the triad. When you take a look at the age, as you pointed out, of the triad, all three legs need modernizing. But the ICBM leg really is the oldest. The Minuteman III, those silos are first deployed in the late 60s. The weapons themselves are deployed in the 70s. To be blunt about it, if Minuteman III missiles were cars, they'd qualify for antique license plates in most states in the United States.
Now, and when you think about what's on the line with that, it's huge. And, you know, we see politicians making a lot of statements on this too, and they're in different camps. And so this is so important that this has to be done right. And the public's voice really matters a lot here.
Okay, with that context, let's turn to Matt George, the expert who led the poll. And I want to be clear here. We work in the policy community and we see a lot of data. When we thought we understood tools like polls, the more we talked to Matt, it became clear that the nuances and the complexity involved with his work were just really, really insightful. So we want to compliment Matt and his team on their work. And, you know, we asked them to come up with an impartial assessment and they really delivered. So Matt, thanks again for being here today.
Hey, it's my pleasure. I really appreciate the opportunity to come and share the results of this poll and some of the information that we've learned with you and your listeners. So thank you very much.
Awesome. Well, you know, and I want to, you know, state that these types of results normally rely on graphics. So we're going to do our best to talk our way through the results. And for anyone who wants to see the data visually, hop onto our website. That's MitchellAerospacePower.org. It's all there. And we'll be able to explain Matt's approach, and he took it from big to small. And by that, I mean, he had sweeping questions regarding broad national priorities and then looked at defense at large and then down towards nuclear deterrence. So Matt, first and foremost, who took the poll?
Yeah, so any public opinion poll is a tool to understand, as Doug was saying, what the truth is on the ground. And any poll is only as good as how accurate the sample is. Now, the sample is the number of people, the type of people that that actually took the poll. What we wanted to do was to mirror what the 2020 electorate looked like. And so we had a sample of 2,150 respondents. We fielded our poll nationally and online. So I mentioned that our methodology mirrors the 2020 voting records, and that's based on exit polling, based on different voter rolls that were taken in each one of the states that we looked at. And then we made sure that our targets matched what the results of the 2020 election were on key demographic markers like gender, race, age, income, geographic region, ideology, all these different markers to make sure that we have a picture perfect idea of who actually voted in the 2020 election and then asked them questions. We also, of note, took some oversamples in the five states that we had discussed earlier, just to make sure that we had that their opinions were represented. Those representatives were then scaled back a little bit within the survey sample to make sure that they didn't overrepresent, so we have a really, really accurate picture of the nation as a whole, but also of those states where there is intercontinental ballistic missiles located within those states as well.
Awesome, I appreciate that rundown. Now, you said you began by asking a broad range of questions on what mattered to them when it comes to national priorities, everything from the economy to defense, healthcare, and the environment. So what were the main takeaways and where does defense stand in the mix?
Yeah, so one of the questions that I love asking in public opinion polls is, over the next 2 years, which of the following issues do you think is the most important for the president and Congress to address? And then we give them like 14 or 17 different options to choose from and have them choose their top three. I've asked this question on a ton of different public opinion polls over the last few years. And the top three right now are: number one is jobs and the economy. Number two is coronavirus. And number three is healthcare. Of note, we fielded this poll, or the same question rather, right after the election. The top three have not really changed. They might have moved a little bit in terms of order and precedence, but it's jobs and the economy, coronavirus, and healthcare. Those are the main issues that people really care about. National security and terrorism falls about in the middle of the list. Of note, also, since the last time that we fielded this question, national security and terrorism is going up that list. So more and more people are actually focused in on national security. It used to be towards the bottom third. Now it's right about in the middle of that list of 14 to 17 different issues that we ask from participants. Another really interesting thing to note is that there are definitely we split out the results, and we like to look at them by different demographics. One of those demographics that we look at is political ideology. And so we get to see where it's different from what Democratic voters think versus what Republican voters think should be the top priorities. And there are clear issues that are Republican priorities versus Democratic priorities. Of note, national security and terrorism leans more towards the Republican side, but there is support for an interest in that issue on both sides.
Now, Matt, is that normal for what you see from all the different surveys that you do?
Yeah, more and more there's less and less agreement between Republicans and Democrats about anything. It seems like they're ideologically split, not just along party lines, but on issues as well. So there are Republican issues, there are Democratic issues, and there's not a ton of agreement. What I found really kind of interesting in this poll is that we did find some agreement. We found some issues that people on both sides of the aisle were willing to come to the middle and talk about solutions forward and modernizing the ground-based leg of nuclear deterrence strategy for the United States.
Wow, that's incredible. Now, on the big picture of the national security questions, how did you assess that? And who do the American people think are our allies, and who are our perceived enemies?
Sure. We asked the American public, American voters, who they think their greatest ally was. Three countries come to the top: the United Kingdom, Canada, and Israel are, for the most part, are the main three that voters are looking at as America's greatest ally. So we have, in addition to the United Kingdom, Canada, and Israel, we also have France, Germany, and Japan rounding out the top six in terms of our greatest ally. Now, in terms of the flip side of that, who do American voters think is our greatest threat? There are four countries that come to the top by a significant margin. The first is China. 63% think that China is our greatest ally, followed by Russia at 53%, followed by North Korea at 47%, and Iran at 36%. After that, Iraq and Afghanistan are close at 21%. People saying that those are our greatest threats as well. And speaking of threats, it's not just about understanding what countries voters believe are the United States' greatest threats, but we also asked our respondents what they think, what actions are the biggest national security threats out there. The top two were both in the camp of cyber attack. So the top thing that people are concerned, that voters are concerned about, is cyber attack by another nation or cyber attack by a terrorist group. And this makes sense, right? Because it's happening all the time, right? It's more likely that cyber attack is going to happen. Some of the other items that were on that list that that fell further down on the concern level were terrorist organizations acquiring nuclear weapons, hostile governments acquiring nuclear weapons, conventional attack by a terrorist group or another nation, nuclear attack by a terrorist group or another nation. I find it really interesting, though, that voters are more concerned about either terrorist organizations or other countries acquiring nuclear weapons than they are about the actual attack of those nuclear weapons. And that leads me to believe that that voters, this is the first sort of hint that we get, that voters recognize and respect the power that deterrence has. So by understanding where people's concerns actually are, we can start to really understand what moves them, what motivates their behavior.
Yeah, it's massively interesting. I'm sure you can answer a lot of different questions based on the data that you have. And one of the things that we wanted to know was whether people actually value defense investment as a whole, and if there's certain areas of defense that they see a greater need than other areas.
We asked our voter group whether or not they believe that military superiority makes them feel more safe or less safe, or does it not make a difference? And unsurprisingly, most people, the vast majority, said that it makes them feel more safe. That makes sense. But we also wanted to see, like, are they just answering that question in the positive because they think that that's what they're supposed to do? They don't really understand what military superiority is. So we asked the flip side of the question. We said, then, if Russia or China had global military superiority, would that make you feel more safe, less safe, or does it not make a difference? And now the numbers flip. And so there has been discussion in, I think, a number of other groups and organizations that military superiority doesn't actually impact security, doesn't actually impact feelings of safety and security in the public. What we find from this poll result, when we take away that, hypothetically take away that military superiority, it absolutely makes a difference. People do feel less safe, less secure if Russia or China is the global military superior force. So what does that mean? It means that we do value as a voting public, military superiority, and therefore the spending that goes into attaining military superiority. In fact, we ask that. So we ask the question, do you believe that spending on national defense projects increases or decreases your feelings of security, or does it not have an impact? And 69% of American voters say that it somewhat or greatly increases their feelings of security. So it's not just this hypothetical idea of military superiority, which is difficult to actually pin down. But when we make it concrete, when we say spending on national defense projects, the spending directly impacts feelings of safety and security as well.
Yeah, I really appreciate this. And I'm sure the listeners are going to be really keen on this as well. But I want to stay focused on nuclear deterrence specifically. So can you walk us through this section and how did you design the questions and what was the intent and what were your specific questions that you asked people?
So I mentioned earlier that Republicans and Democrats very rarely agree on things just in general. One of the things that was surprising to me was we got a 91% agreement on a statement. And I'm going to read that statement now. It's America's nuclear deterrence capability is critical to our national safety and security. It should be one of the highest priorities of the Department of Defense. 91% of voters, including agreed with that statement, including 54% who strongly agreed with it. Now, I mentioned what is that bipartisan, like what the Republicans, the Democrats, how do they fall out on it? We actually have agreement across the aisle on that as well. So if you're looking at Republicans, you actually get 96% agreement. If you're looking at Democrats, you actually get 88% agreement, a massive amount of agreement on that statement. As I mentioned, it's very rare that you get people on both sides of the aisle agreeing on something, but there's one. The other thing that we learned is that voters believe that that nuclear deterrence, modern deterrence, is equally critical to national and global security. We asked how important or unimportant is it to our national security is that the U.S. has modern nuclear deterrence capabilities. We asked the same question for global security as well, and the numbers were relatively the same. It leads us to believe that voters really do believe that it's not just about security here. It's about the umbrella that the U.S. nuclear deterrence system has over our ally countries as well.
I'm really surprised to see the overwhelming level of support across both sides of the aisle, which is just massively important. And when we first kicked off this effort, I know none of us thought people would broadly resonate with the value afforded by the nuclear weapons in our arsenal. And it's been a long time since the Berlin Wall fell and people, you know, have really had to think about these tools. So what happens when you gave people some more data about the triad? Because as I understand it, they didn't have much context to go on in the previous questions we discussed.
Yeah, they didn't. We gave them very little information because we wanted to understand where their baseline perceptions were. As we progressed in the survey, we gave them information. And I want to be very clear here. We did not give them arguments. We didn't draw a conclusion from any of the information that we provided. That's an argument. We instead provided information and allowed our respondents to then make a conclusion about what they would do based on that information. So we gave them four choices for each one of these times that we gave them information. The choices that they were allowed to choose were U.S. ICBM should be replaced with a modern system. Second one is U.S. ICBM should be refurbished to extend their current life. The third one is U.S. ICBM should be eliminated entirely, or because this is a complicated issue, I'm not sure was a fourth option. So what is the information that we provided them at the beginning? First thing is the current U.S. ground-based intercontinental ballistic missiles that are used for our ground-based nuclear response capabilities are all over 50 years old and require attention in order to function correctly. Again, information, no conclusion. We ask them to then choose their conclusion based on that information. 54%, a majority of voters, say that the ICBM should be replaced with a modern system. As Doug mentioned earlier, that is the GBSD program that is currently underway. We then gave them a little bit more information. And the next time we said, over the last decade, China and Russia have made significant investments in their country's nuclear weapons capability. For example, we estimate that the majority of Russia and China's systems are comprised of modern technology. Now, the number of people who say that our ICBM should be replaced with a modern system rises to about 2/3 of voters who agree with that. Of note, you might say, like, okay, well, what about cost, right? So are you telling them information about the cost of what the replacement or the refurbishment might be? We did in a question before these, the ones that I'm focused on right now, where we said, we gave them a choice. We said the United States should have ground-based nuclear defense capabilities or should not have ground-based nuclear capabilities. And we gave them some additional information. On the flip side, we say some say that it costs too much to maintain and that there are other options to keep the U.S. safe. That's a distillation of the argument that's out there in the public sphere. Only 19% of voters pick that option, right? So even when you add in the idea that this might cost some, voters still, 8 in 10 of them, still want to make sure that the U.S. has a modern ground-based nuclear defense capability.
Well, I mean, those numbers are really overwhelming. So I've got to ask, what other questions were on the survey?
Yeah, there were quite a few. We wanted to understand really what, paint a really, really clear picture of public sentiment on these issues. For example, we asked them how they would devote spending to these different types of defense projects. So we asked the question, in your opinion, should the United States spend more, less, or the same amount on the following defense projects? Then we gave them a bunch of different ones. The ones that are really important and the ones that I want to focus on today, we asked them about investing in surveillance and intelligence collection capabilities. 55% of voters want to spend more. That makes sense, right? Because we were talking before about how cybersecurity is a top priority. Cyber terrorism is a concern that they have. So it makes sense that they would want to spend more on that. 55% want to spend more on investing in surveillance and intelligence collection capabilities. 52%, just 3% less, want to spend more on modernizing U.S. ground-based nuclear capabilities. So even though it's not as big of a concern, voters are still willing to devote more spending to modernizing our capabilities, both on the ground, in the air, and at sea as well, respectively. They're all about the same amount in terms of how voters responded in terms of the wanting to spend more on that. Of note, almost no voters, 8%, 5%, 7%, very, very small numbers, want to actually spend less on any of the defense projects that I just talked about. And then we wanted to put a little bit of context in there as well, right? Spend more, spend less. It's easy to do if you don't have a dollars and cents number attached to it. So we gave them one. We said that nuclear deterrence makes up about 5% of our total defense budget. Should we continue to devote this percentage to nuclear deterrence? So now they've got a little bit of context. And now we see that it is 81% of voters would either like to continue that 5% or devote more towards nuclear deterrence. And that is a significant number who would want to either maintain the status quo or devote more to it. Again, those who would, only 6% actually want to devote less to nuclear deterrence. It's a very small number.
Well, it's mind-blowing that, you know, you're in single digits for folks that don't want to support these programs financially. So again, Matt, this is incredibly impressive work and we really, really appreciate it. I've got to ask Gonzo, Stutson, Doug, what did you think when you first saw all this data?
Yeah, Gonzo here. I'll start off. One thing that didn't surprise me, I'll start with that, is the fact that a cyber attack by another nation or a terrorist group came out on top, because our nation is experiencing hundreds, maybe thousands of those attacks every day. And right below that, we have nuclear threats by terrorist groups, states to acquire nuclear weapons and so forth. And in fact, that could lead to just devastating effects on our nation. That is an existential threat. So the rack and stack of the threats comes out to the most likely cyber, followed by the most devastating, the most deadly, which is nuclear. The one thing that did surprise me when you got to the part on America's greatest threat, China came out ahead of Russia. And that was interesting to me. But then if you step back, we are reading in the papers every day about China's repression of the Uyghurs, the death of democracy in Hong Kong, its military expansion in the South China Sea, and the fact that China is building hundreds and hundreds of fixed silos for ICBMs, and there's no limit to what China can put on those weapons. Now, we're limited with Russia because of the New START Treaty to 1,550 nuclear weapons, but China could put 10 individual reentry vehicles on each one of its new ICBMs. And they're doing it in a handful of years, where it's going to take through 2035 to modernize our 400 existing silos. General Hyten, the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said, quote, China's building what we are modernizing basically overnight.
Yeah, I've got two things here, Slick. First off, I'm really actually surprised the overarching level of support defense had. If you think about Iraq and Afghanistan over the last 20 years, which now, interestingly, the average American public looks at threats towards us, it's interesting to me that defense and the return on investment was viewed as a positive, because we had tremendous level of commitment in those two countries. It didn't work the way we wanted to. And so I thought that would cause some people to really question defense's value. The other thing, and I said it earlier, was I am very, very surprised about how overwhelming the level of support is for strategic deterrence and the triad specifically. And we went about this poll for objectivity. It did us no good to do some kind of propaganda exercise to just support what we think to make us feel better. I really wanted to know where things were at in order to do this as impartially as possible. And so we're just really surprised that the numbers came back that way. But I think it's important for actors in the space, whether it be Congress, Department of Defense, individuals like ourselves, the media, et cetera, to take that into account, that what we're seeing in the op-ed column is different than where people's heads are really at.
Yeah, I'll jump in by saying I was pleasantly surprised at public support. If you think about it, about half these respondents were either not born or of voting age at the end of the Cold War, yet this whole subject remains so much part of the American psyche, and it's a very positive one. I would say there are some other observations, and coming from a very professional job of this survey, and that is, there are some differences out there in responses in terms of demographics. Of course, Matt pointed out some differences between those that identify as Democrats or Republicans. And that's very instructive as far as Department of Defense getting out there and shoring up some of the demographics that need a little more educating. Matt, you know, very interesting that when you tell the American public that the ICBMs are 50 years old after you ask them about the ICBMs, support for their modernization goes up. And context is very, very important. And as Doug has said on a number of occasions, you know, the American public generally believes that everything that military has is new and state of the art. And that's not true. So we need to be forthright with that. Some good byproducts besides the great support that came out of the survey.
Doug, I'd like to add one point quickly on where GBSD came out in terms of funding. ISR was on top, and I'm just interpreting here, but that could be related. Now, the American public have seen what's happened to us as a nation in previous intelligence failures have occurred. It is so important to have an ISR capable, space-based, airborne, and terrestrial, that can detect potential threats so we can take actions to deter or prevent those attacks before they happen, especially when you're talking about nuclear weapons.
Awesome. And Matt, did anything surprise you about this poll?
Yeah, a few things. The first one is to sort of echo what Doug said, that this is not really the current conversation. The objective questions and the results that they got within this survey are kind of opposite of what we hear in national media, in blogs. If you're reading about this online, it's counterintuitive, right? The results are completely different than what the current conversation is. What that suggests to me is that people actually do recognize the impact of deterrence, right? So deterrence is supposed to be something that is very difficult to pull around because if it's working really well, you don't really notice it. That said, I think that voters, when we're giving them a small amount of information, they can make conclusions on what's needed and really start to understand that perhaps their perceptions about where our current nuclear capability doesn't match with reality. The other thing that I will say that surprised me is that voters agreed on something, just in general. That does not happen very much. And so for voters to have agreement on an issue like this, and the astounding amount of agreement that there was, I really do think is unique. I think it is worth mentioning because it doesn't happen that frequently. So that certainly surprised me.
Yeah, Matt, that's a great point. I appreciate you bringing that up. So Doug, now that we have all of this data, what's the plan from here?
Yeah, we're in the middle of a discussion phase that we've obviously done some public engagement on it in the last few weeks here. We're going to be up on the Hill discussing with it, Department of Defense, et cetera. People are really interested in the numbers. And it continues to be very relevant. I mean, this week alone, an amendment came down in the House of Representatives for an amendment to the Defense Authorization Act that really sought to defund the GBSD effort and a lot of the other elements of the Triad modernization. And the House Armed Services Committee actually cited this poll in their response to that. And so I think these numbers are going to be very relevant going forward. I think it did make a lot of people think in different ways. We obviously are going to continue supporting Triad modernization because we fundamentally believe the world is a safer place with it. And it's the classic case of the stronger your Triad, the less chance of actual war. The weaker it is, the more it incentivizes an adversary to take a risk and actually push towards a confrontation. And so it's something that is an imperative for us, and we're going to roll forward aggressively. But it's, you know, we live in a democracy, and so to know where public sentiment stands is crucial because what the American public wants is going to be reflected in policy and budget decisions.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, with 88% of people agreeing on the importance of this per the poll, it drives that point home. So once again, I just want to say thanks to Matt, Studs, Doug, and Gonzo for being here today.
Thanks, Matt.
A great discussion, Slick.
Thanks, Slick, and great job, Matt.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Once again, if you'd like to dive into the data yourself, you can find our report on the findings in the show notes or at MitchellAerospacePower.org. With that, I'd like to extend a big thank you to you, our listeners, for your continued support and for tuning into today's show. If you like what you've heard today, don't forget to hammer down on that like button and follow or subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage. You can also leave a comment for us to let us know what you think about our show or areas you would like to hear more about. As always, you can join in on the conversation by following the Mitchell Institute on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn, and you can always find us at MitchellAerospacePower.org. Until next time, this is John Slickbaum. Stay safe and check six.